Hi, and welcome to the Let's Make It Rain podcast. I'm your host, Davinia Tomlinson. This podcast is for the rainmakers, those women who are breaking down walls, building their own empires, defying convention and rejecting stereotypes. Women who are unafraid to have open, honest conversations about money among friends and to share the truths we've been told to keep secret. Don't forget to subscribe, share, and download wherever you usually get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, then please leave us a 5-star review. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of the Let's Make It Rain podcast. Today, I'm delighted to have with me Toby Oridane. Toby is the founder of Black Ballad, a business she established in 2014. Black Ballad is the leading media and data company for Black women in Britain and beyond. Toby, thank you so much for joining me here today. It's a real pleasure to have you. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me. How are you?
I'm really, really well. I'm excited to have you here with us today. Why don't you share with the listeners a bit about you and your business?
So my name is Toby Oridane. As you said, I'm 31. I'm the founder and CEO of Black Ballad. I created Black Ballad because I guess you'd say my trade is that I'm a journalist, I'm a writer. I've worked for many mainstream publications in a freelance capacity or full-time capacity. So my last job before I went full-time on my business was at the BBC, but I've written for The Stylist, The Guardian, Grazia, iNews, The Independent. And over the course of, I say, probably about my 7-year career as a journalist, I hope I've got that number right. I just realised that there was a lack of Black women in the offices and our stories weren't being told. And I felt so strange that all these publications would be kind of like, we want to tell women's stories, we want to get to the heart of women's issues, you know, we're the best publication for women in Britain, but women in Britain or women's stories stopped at white middle-class women who were thin, able-bodied, straight. And I just kept noticing this recurring pattern. And I was just like, there's a gap in the market because, you know, obviously, you know, I have a network of amazing Black women of different ages and at different stages in their lives. And because I was jealous, people would say, oh, can you recommend a publication for Black women? And I'll be like, oh, by the way, Black women in Britain or Europe, not America. We all read Essence. We all read Ebony. We want something that's British, that, you know, or even European. I just didn't have an answer. So I think working in the industry and seeing how biased and how little it cared about Black women, and then having, you know, access to so many phenomenal Black women, asking for this product, it was just like, to me, there's a gap in the market here and maybe it's one that I can fill. And that's why Black Ballad started in 2014. And here we are, you know, in 2014 was a free access blog with volunteers. And now here we are in 2021 as a business that employs 60 people full time and has paid over 350 creatives and freelancers. It's been an amazing journey.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to stick a pin in your point about, you know, the total amount of money that you have. I mean, you've almost created a kind of a micro industry in and of itself, in terms of the total amount of money that you've been able to pay to very talented writers who wouldn't otherwise have had a platform or have had a place to share their opinions and share their voice. But before we get to that point, you know, one of the things that strikes me, and, you know, having followed your journey and been a lifelong, or certainly as long as Black Ballad has existed, a fan of the business for absolutely the reason that you've given. I mean, in the UK, prior to Black Ballad coming along, there was a real dearth of publications that were specifically targeting Black women that were British. And, you know, there's a whole, you know, separate conversation around identity and what it means to be a Black Briton and all of these sorts of things. But certainly we would look to our kind of counterparts in the US, and we were very, you know, we remain, you know, very close to US culture, but we have a very unique culture ourselves as Black British women. And so the thing that strikes me about, you know, everything that you have described is the idea of you being an accidental entrepreneur. Is that how you would describe yourself, in the sense that, you know, and it's a similar thing for me in Raincheck, you'd identified a problem. So you were forging ahead with your career as a journalist, but actually the voices were getting louder and louder from your potential audience who were crying out for something that just wasn't available. And so on that basis, you decided to step into the void rather than you maybe pursuing entrepreneurship as a career path. Which way around was it?
Accidental, or I think the other word I'd use to describe it is reluctant. Okay. I never, ever wanted to be an entrepreneur. Funny enough, my good friend is Florence Adepoju. She's the founder of MDM Flow, a beauty brand in the UK that is inclusive to all skin types and skin tones. And she prioritizes darker skin first in the way she makes her products. And we've known each other since we were 16 or 17. And she has always wanted to be an entrepreneur. Like, she's always said she's going to own her own beauty brand. You know, that's her thing. She didn't like working for people. I remember, she'd phone me after, her part-time job and be like, I don't want to work for anyone. I want to have my own business. Like, university was a route to make sure she had the skills to have her own beauty brand. I was completely opposite. I remember I used to circle the name of the editorial and entertainment assistant of The Stylist, and I circle and be like, because my name's going to be there. And wow. I used to do The Stylist back to front all the time. Like, when I was in uni, I went to King's College. If Florence come and visit me in my accommodation, she couldn't come unless she gave me The Stylist. Like, I was so devoted to it. My mum used to know, I moved out in the first year of uni because I do live in London, but I wanted that experience. And my mum would actually collect The Stylist so that when I come back home, just in case I hadn't got it, I was so devoted to it. And I was like, this is a publication I want to work for. I'd read every single woman's lifestyle magazine. Like, I spend so much money on them. And I just look at all the positions and be like, I want to be a columnist, or I want to get this job first. I had no intention of being an entrepreneur. So I was forced to be an entrepreneur, I think, because the journalism industry is so insidious and it doesn't allow new faces in. And if you're the editorial assistant at The Stylist, you're most likely to be the next features writer at Cosmo. And if you're the feature writer at Cosmo, you're most likely to be the next deputy features editor at Elle. And you go round in a circle. And this circle of women are white, they're thin, they're able-bodied, they're mostly middle class. And it's they're like clones, I'm going to be honest, of each other. And I didn't have the language when I started applying for these jobs to kind of articulate why I wasn't getting anywhere, because I could write, I had experience. I worked at a TV magazine for 18 months, but I just couldn't get a job. And when you have the door slammed in your face so many times, I think you have a few options. You would change total direction and go into another career, or you forge your own path. And I've never wanted to be anything but a journalist, which is really weird now because I'm a CEO and I'm not a journalist anymore. And like, what I do in the business, although editorial falls underneath me, it's not my day-to-day anymore. But I always wanted to write for other women. That was what I felt I was called to do. It was what my passion was. And I actually knew I was always called to write for Black women. Even in my degree, I specialised on issues of race, because actually it's American studies. So I studied a lot around African-American culture, literature, history, politics. So I'd always wanted to write for Black women in Britain. And I thought that was going to happen by being in an established publication and trying to turn it on its head. And that's what I thought I was going to do, but that wasn't it. So I would say accidental, reluctant, forced entrepreneur I was. But I think it's been the best accident to ever happen to me, if I'm honest. Besides my daughter.
Oh my gosh, that's a whole other conversation. I'm sure there are many of us as mothers that can attest to the accidents. But myself included as an accident. But yeah, anyway.
Yeah, it forced me to do this job in a way that is unfiltered, away from the white gaze, that isn't whitewashed. And I don't think I could have done it any other way, in the way that I do it, if I was in an established publication. So it was definitely not, it was definitely not something I didn't think at 31 I'd be working for myself in the way that I am now.
Wow. One thing that, you know, really resonates with me, you know, particularly given my journey is, you know, having established Raincheck. When I first started the business, I used to receive a lot of criticism from people, or at least feedback from people. So there were, you know, some of it had a negative slant, some of it was kind of proffered on the basis of, you know, I'm just trying to help Dav. So, you know, people would say to me, why does it have to be just for women? You know, why are you making it so exclusive? You know, and this is when people try to, you know, try and dress it up as, you know, you're so talented, you can help so many. Why aren't you trying to, you know, offer your services to men? And, you know, then there were other people that would be, you know, go as extreme as saying, I think this is segregationist. I don't really like it. And this, you know, I would hear this feedback from women. And so something that you said that really stands out for me is this idea that you wanted to step away from the white gaze and to, you know, focus on promoting or building a platform that could service a very specific group of women within the UK that have, you know, arguably historically been underserved, ignored, marginalized, neglected, you know, insert other synonym here.
Yeah.
But also, you mentioned about, you know, thin, able-bodied, heterosexual. Yeah. Talk to me about that. Talk to me about some of the feedback that you received from people within the industry who, you know, when I reflect on my journey and people saying to me, there's no market for this stuff. And I'm like, but I'm talking to all women and you're telling me half the UK population or half the global population is too small a market? Ridiculous. What was your experience?
It's interesting. So when we first started Black Banners, a free access blog, I think Black women were so surprised at how good it was. They was like, it's really good. So the bar, there wasn't really a bar because there wasn't much to compare it to. And I know obviously you have the amazing hair magazines that have been around for ages and obviously it's been Pride, but it was a digital offering. So it was kind of hard to compare. So in a way, I think that was great because we're not the first. I'll never sit and say that we're the first, but I think because we were so early in offering an only digital offering that was British and European for Black women, there wasn't much to compare it to. So it was all very positive. I did have Black women say that, oh, funny enough, because my husband is my business partner, and someone, a Black woman at his church, came up to him and critiqued him and was like, what you and your, you know, your girlfriend are doing, you know, I don't think this is good. This is really kind of divisive. And I think last year, like after 6 years of doing Black Banners, she sent him an apology email and said, wow, like, I was wrong. So he's had that feedback said face to face. I haven't had it. I've had it through some LinkedIn messages, actually. I remember some people being like, some Black women being like, I found your, you know, blog, so it was really good, really well written. Maybe, you know, it's a, you know, we should consider other, you know, races, be more inclusive. And I think my feedback has always been, when Joe Elvin was the editor of Glamour, which was the biggest publication for women in Britain at the time, was the best-selling publication month on month, did you ask her these questions? Because I don't remember seeing really any Black women on her covers or any dark-skinned Black women on her covers or in her pages. Did you ask, you know, Alexander Shulman, the editor of Vogue, which is, you know, might not be the best-selling, but it's the biggest, you know, women's lifestyle publication and most prestigious, before Edward took over, are you going to ask her that question? If you're going to ask me that question,
right,
you should ask them that question first, because I'm creating what I'm creating because they're not even bothering to see you. So I always had that retort ready. I was like, don't ask me that question if you're not going to ask them first. But that was a very small, I have to say, it was mainly positive. Mm. And I think that was when only people wanted it, because people genuinely, there was a gratefulness for it. And I didn't expect that sort of emotion to be evoked. So that's when I knew that it was wanted by the majority, overwhelming positive reaction. But I think where it's come, where the biggest doubt has come, is from like when I was securing investment. People didn't know if it was going to work. People couldn't see how I was going to make an 8 or 9 figure business. Can it be a unicorn, which is, you know, basically language investors use to say, can it fly on the stock market? Can you, you know, get to this sort of, you know, status where, you know, it's £1 billion, $1 billion and
yeah,
all of that. And so I think investors were where I saw the biggest sort of resistance to Black Ballad. You know, some encouraged me to think about being more inclusive in order to get money. Some just didn't think it was a good idea. You know, I had one person, a Black woman actually, not an investor, but she's very well known, very well connected. And she said she wouldn't introduce me to any investors that she knew until I changed the whole scope of my business.
Wow.
She said that this will never work, it won't be profitable, and that I should do something that Black women care about, maybe like a hair business, and have it as a blog on the side. And I think that was the most hurtful, I think that was the most hurtful sort of critique that I found, that I'd come across in the business. Because one, this was someone that I really respected. Two, she was acting as a gatekeeper and wouldn't let people make up their own minds.
Yes.
And I think three, that the assumption that she had of Black women, that all we care about is hair.
That we don't have the range. Yeah.
Yeah. And I just thought, not only have you, I guess, doubted my business, but you don't even believe in Black women, that we want more than hair. And I think that was really sad to me. And I think that was the moment when I said, I think that's more about you than me. So there's been moments, but they're very few and far between, I have to say. Like, on the whole, I have, the community we've cultivated has been so positive, so amazing, so encouraging. So they're very few and far between experiences. But I think sometimes when the experiences are so few and far between, they're ones you never forget. That makes sense.
Yes, absolutely.
Which is why I'm able to point out, you know, the woman that went to my husband's church and, you know, the woman that I had that interaction with. So yeah,
right, it's just like the woman who said to me that, so when I did, you know, I did a lot of kind of customer research or market research before launching Rain Check, and I did kind of one-to-one interviews, focus groups, survey, and, you know, I basically was tapping up everyone in my network specifically with the survey to say, send this link to all the women, you know, because I just want to get opinions and see what their thoughts are. And you know, I remember sending it to one of the guys that I studied with, and he was like, Dav, you know, this woman from my network would really like to have a conversation with you because she's got very strong views on it. And I was like, cool, let's have a chat. And this woman basically said to me, I don't know her from Adam. And she said, you know, I really think, very similar to what you were saying about it being divisive, she's like, I don't think the way to solve some of these financial gaps is to highlight our difference. Money is money. There is no difference at all. And just because you dress up your business in pink, and tie it with a bow doesn't mean that because I have a vagina, I will be interested in it. And I was like, well, thank you for that information and also a reminder of our anatomy. But that piece of feedback really stuck with me because it's a bit like, it's almost like having Stockholm syndrome. And, you know, you being the person, you know, that is ultimately somebody that would be within the target audience. But also it was a really, I suppose it was one of my first lessons of business, which is that you can have a target audience. And she could absolutely fit within the target demographic of, you know, these customer avatars or whatever.
Yeah.
But whatever you're producing, it's not for everyone. And I think that's a lesson we have to learn.
It's not. And I think that, you know, there's just broader conversations to have that when we have businesses that have purposes that is about, you know, what, you know, yours is, a, you know, your business is about giving women the tools to be financially free and wealthy and have flexibility.
Right.
There's still that underlying mission of rejecting patriarchy. But for patriarchy to work, you have to have agents of patriarchy, which are often women who, you know, perpetuate these messages of, you know, you should be kind of grateful. Let's assimilate.
Yes.
And, you know, kind of, you know, be grateful for what we get. And if we get a pay rise, you know, that's great. And if we don't, I saw the tweet, the former CEO of Pepsi said, I can never
yes.
ask for a pay rise. And I just thought, yeah, okay, like, you know, I think it's also very selfish, actually. Even when I think about, you know, those that from our community, that was like, maybe we should just, you know, be happy when we get a feature here and there and kind of just blend in. is kind of really selfish, because you're comfortable doing that, and yes. maybe you're able to create a decent lifestyle doing that, but that doesn't work for all of us.
Right.
And it has repercussions that can be, you know, financially damaging, mentally damaging, emotionally damaging. And I think that's often the thing that people look at these businesses and be like, oh, you know, maybe you should just kind of blend in, but they have bigger purposes. They're doing much good for society. And I think that's why we can't give up on businesses like yours and mine.
Absolutely. So just coming back to, you know, the obviously Black Ballad is a media platform, but the thing that I've always loved about your journey and the thing that you articulate all the time, even when you, I think you did an end of year infographic and talked about, you know, how much, even if you didn't use the language, even if you didn't say wealth, but how much you were generating, how much money you were generating for these contributors and why that was so important to you. Can you talk to me about that? You know, the idea that, you know, if not from day one, as early as you were able to, it was really important to you that you were able to pay contributors for their work. And I say this as somebody who, obviously, having had a career in finance and then stepping away to work for myself, one of the challenges, for example, that I come up against is, you know, being invited to lots of things. You know, when money is trending, Black women are trending, and so I'm invited to speak at lots of different things. And certainly in the early days of Raincheck, you know, you're doing everything because you're trying to build brand awareness yeah. and profile, and you're doing lots of speaking engagements, panels and what have you for free, until there comes a tipping point where you realize the amount of time it's taking me to prepare for these speaking engagements and the opportunity cost of my time in not being spent on business development that can generate an income so that yeah. I can pay my light bill and buy groceries and send my daughter to her dance lessons, you know, is quite significant. So yeah. can you just talk to me about, you know, the money that you've been able to generate for Black Ballad and your whole ethos around that?
Yeah, so I think we've probably, God, we've paid upwards of, like, I'd probably say, like, at this point, going towards about £400,000 we put in, wow. like, but that's freelance and full-time salaries of Black women as well. I don't want to mislead anyone in, like, you know, that, but I think we've actually had about over 300, we've paid over 300 probably freelancers and creatives that are Black to work with us, whether it be on a project basis or one-off article. And then we've had like a one part-time member, and then including myself, there's been like 5 full-time staff of Black women. So it's really important that I do, you know, that I clarify that and, you know, make sure people know how that's been, you know, distributed, because you never know, some of our investors might be listening to this. But I think it started when, you know, journalism is poorly paid, it's so competitive.
Right.
And often journalism is dominated by those who went to Oxbridge. Now, not everybody that goes to Oxbridge is working class, I'm sorry, middle class, and, you know, whatever, I'm very aware of that. But journalism is full of young people whose parents can afford for them to do free internships, which is why media is so generic and focused on one particular audience, because it's serving that audience, because they're creating that news agenda. And I remember working for free, and I come from a very working class background, so I had to have a part-time job, go uni and intern, and it was hard. It was so hard. And I just remember being like, you work your absolute bum off as an intern, you're not getting any pay. I remember one internship, no pay, no travel money, no lunch money.
Wow.
And I was working so hard, and I had my own pages in this publication. And I look back now and it's pretty disgusting. And like, I had my own pages. And I remember once my editor emailed me, was like, oh, you're late with your pages. And I had a uni essay to finish. And I was just like, I've been doing this for a year, and not one person has even offered me a ticket to go and see something. Like, because you get free tickets to see shows and stuff yeah. like that. Not one person at this bloody publication, and it was a Black publication actually, has offered me even a ticket. And I remember my mum being like, you're talented and they're using you. Like,
yes.
Like, no. And I just remember being like,
yes.
I'm like, I'm not working for this publication ever again. Like, I'm just not, I don't want to be associated with it. And I remember being like, journalism needs to change, because I'm really lucky that my mum has a property in London, lives in London, but she's still working class. She bought her house like nearly 40 years ago. So that's why she has a property in London. But And I was also very privileged to have a weekend job that, you know, I worked, you know, nights and, you know, weekends. So I was never resting. And I was just like, I would hate to be part of the problem, even though I'm in journalism. So when I got the opportunity to do Black Ballad, I remember someone said, piece of advice is pay yourself first and everyone else afterwards. And I remember that stuck with me. And then with the experience that I had at that publication where I wasn't paid anything, I said, I'm going to do things differently. I'm going to pay people first before myself. And people thought I was crazy, but it attracted much better talent. The content was better. Memberships went up. So it was an astute business move. But I just didn't want to be part of the problem. I just didn't want, and also, no matter how much we talk about, you know, money, capitalism, or whatever your views are, the truth is we tie our what sense of worth to how much we get paid. That is the truth. Let's not deny it. Mm. And I felt so worthless because I was writing for this publication and not getting paid, even though my writing was... I was responsible for two whole pages and sections in a publication. That's an editor's job. Yeah. And I was doing it at like 20 years old. Like, that's literally, you know.
So it's just exploitative.
It was 100%. So I just said, no, I'm never going to do it. And I pride myself on paying people, not just paying people on time. Like, those that, you know, in Black Ballad that, you know, we've got Aisha, who's amazing, our office manager, does payroll. I remember first when she came on, we have to pay people on time. Like, I don't like late payments. I know what it's like to be a freelancer as well, when, you know, as a freelancer for a long time, and you have to, you know, move your bills to a certain time in the month just to make sure you're going to get paid on time. You know, you have to have an overdraft because you can't be guaranteed that, you know, you've worked for a publication for a month and they may owe you £2,000, but you can't guarantee it's coming in 4 weeks. So you have to have an overdraft. I didn't even have an overdraft in university. Like, I'm not that person. I didn't have an overdraft in university. It didn't go over once. When I became freelance, I had to get an overdraft because people just don't pay you on time. You're forced into, you know, debt just to kind of get by. And I was just like, I don't want to be part of that problem. I don't want any... especially young Black women, to feel how I felt when I was working for a publication. It was exploiting me. And then you work for these old publications who have so much money and then just don't want to pay you on time. And, like, I think that's where I kind of felt that I had to do better. I had to do better, not just because of the audience, but I had to do better by those that were working for me. And I've always had this, I say to my full-time staff members, my job is actually not to look after the readers. My job is to look after you guys. I need to create the best culture for you guys so you create the best content to make sure we get members and members stay. Yes. And I think that's how I've always thought about business. And that's why pay is so important to me, because as much as I can be a good boss, you know, I'm fair, but I like my deadlines. I like things done a certain way. I also make sure people are treated right when it comes to money. You know, we have incentive structures. We have bonuses. I think it's important to make sure people know you respect them on all levels.
Yes. I mean, you raised a very interesting point there when you said, you know, whether we like it or not, I'm paraphrasing, but whether we like it or not, our sense of self-worth is pegged to financial worth. And it's interesting because you raised the tweet that, or I don't know where she mentioned it, the interview or whatever it was, that Indra Nooyi had made, that comment. Yes. That she'd made, the former PepsiCo yeah. CEO had made, that, which was essentially to say that she finds the idea of asking for a pay increase cringeworthy, and that, you know, that really we should be grateful to have the opportunities in the first place. Now, of course, she's speaking from a place of extreme privilege, being a multimillionaire. And, you know, I do wonder some of the other contributory factors that would have led her to make such a statement. But when you think about young women and, you know, really striving and having these conversations, trying to build their careers, when they receive, you know, when you're looking to potentially the elders in certain industries, and, you know, you're looking for mentors who can guide you and lead you along the way, I feel that, you know, to receive information like that, advice like that, or even to hear things like that, it can throw you for a loop, because you'll be thinking, oh, you know, already I feel a bit nervous about asking for my worth in the first place. So if you hear, you know, really powerful women in industry suggesting that it's, you know, it's not quite the right thing to do, and we should be grateful, particularly in an age where, you know, we've got this obsession with gratitude, and there is a place for gratitude, but there is also a place for earning what you're worth.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
No, it's, when I saw that tweet, I actually saw it through the Raincheck account. I had actually said, must be nice. You must have so much money in the bank, you don't need to ask for a pay rise.
Yes.
But not all women are lucky enough to be in that position. And I don't think you should feel bad for not wanting to... I don't think you should feel bad for wanting a pay rise. I think, you know, the thing that I thought about was with Black Ballon, obviously, with, you know, the Black Lives Matter resurgence last year, everybody went to work for Black Ballon. Everybody wants to work with us. You know, it was great. And we had a baby company that wanted to work with us, and they sent me some baby products, because I just had my daughter, and they, you know, got, you know, they wanted us on the phone, love to work for you, do this, this, that, and the other. I said, okay, cool, what's the budget? Oh, we don't have any budget. Then there's no partnership. And like, there's nothing. And I constantly get asked, the companies, the well-known companies that come and say, you know, we'd love to work with Black Ballard, we love your audience, your reach, your engagement. I'm always like, can you outline a budget? And I'm always like, well, for that, you'll get this. No, I can't go any further. But if you up the budget, I can then, you know, I guess, you know, I can up what we can do. And at one point, I was so scared to ask for money when it came to companies. I was so scared to be like, that's a lot of money. That's basically, you know, chicken change for the amount of work you want me to do.
Yeah.
And I think it takes confidence building. Like, once you do it once, twice, you know, three times, it gets easier. And like the whole company know that, like, when it comes to those things, they're like, yeah, so we're passing it over to you. So I'll just ask. I'll be like, what's the budget? And I'll just say how it is. And it's not easy to ask. And if anyone's listening to this, I don't think you should feel bad that you don't have the confidence to ask yet, because it is a process and you have to get better at it. But if you don't ask once, you never know what the answer will be. Never, ever, ever know. So I think anyone that's listening to this, if you want to ask for that paycheck, that pay rise, just ask. The worst they can say is no.
Yes.
And it's not... It doesn't feel that bad afterwards. To be honest, it probably motivate you to go get another job with a higher pay.
Exactly.
So ask.
So just changing direction slightly, you and your husband obviously run Black Ballard together. And, you know, it's particularly interesting to me because, you know, having read or followed, you know, lots of the, you know, senior women in business, I remember when Sheryl Sandberg released or published her book, Lean In, there was huge controversy over one, you know, a very small section of the book in which she talked about, you know, the most important career decision a woman could make, which was who she would marry. And, you know, I think it threw up lots of kind of, you know, she's anti-feminist and, you know, why is she talking about marriage and we need to be focusing on what we can do. But that's not the vast majority of people's reality. And I don't think she was actually pushing marriage as the optimum construct. Instead, what she was trying to suggest is that if you are somebody that chooses to be, and she was focusing specifically on heterosexual marriage because that's what she knows, that's what her experience is of, if you're somebody that chooses to be in a romantic relationship with a man, choose wisely because it will have implications for your career. As somebody that works with her husband, Toby, what is your view on that?
As someone that works with my husband, as someone that defines herself as a feminist I'm a Black feminist, you know, my feminism revolves around Black women and the issues we go through. Like, I'm going to be honest. I think she's 100% right.
Mm-hmm.
I do. And I think I will say your partner, and you know, I'm married to a guy, I'm heterosexual, but I have friends in different, you know, who are different sexualities. You can never deny the influence your partner has on you. You cannot. You're building a life with somebody. You're trying to make two individuals walk along a parallel path. Therefore, you have to compromise. You have to say, I'm going to do this and you're going to do that. Your partner is the human, I think, that will have the most influence on you, whether you like it or not. my husband was the one who said you should do Black Ballad. He's my biggest supporter, my biggest cheerleader. Being CEO of a company as a woman, there are so many people who look to him to be like, you know, oh, you know, when I was talking, they would look at him and think that he's the CEO. And, you know, I'm just a front because for Black women, I'm just a front. And one of the things that I always really respect about my husband, he would stop people midway and be like, I'm not the CEO. She is.
Excellent.
And it is so important. Even to this day, like, I think even sometimes, I think sometimes people that work with us sometimes, I think sometimes even they may think he's the CEO, and he will just be like, don't ask me the money questions, ask her. Like, and don't get me wrong, I hate the number aspect of the numbers when it comes to business, and I've had to learn it, and he has taught me so much, so I'm so prepared. Yes. Like, I'm prepared to answer anything. You know, my husband's actually a natural born entrepreneur. He's that person in school that was selling sweets and doing all of this, and he had a car washing business. He's always, again, never wanted to work for anyone. He's always wanted to have his own business. So when I had this vision for Black Ballad, there was a lot of work that I had to do to learn about entrepreneurship and being a businesswoman. And he really took the time to teach me. It feels like a different language sometimes when you're talking to investors. And he took the time to teach me and to give me confidence and to champion me like no one else. And I always say there would be no Black Ballad without my husband. He's my first investor, you know.
I love that.
I remember when I started Black Ballad and I was talking about it, and, you know, we weren't married at that point. We'd been together for, I think, like 3 years. And I had to pay for the site and I had to pay for all these things. I didn't pay for anything. He paid for everything. He was my first investor. You know, my husband has taken out loans for me to do this. Like, we've been lucky enough to be able to pay off those loans and stuff like that now. But he has sacrificed so much for me financially to do this because he's believed in me so much. If I didn't have my husband, there would be no Black Ballad. So I think it's so important. And when we had our daughter, I remember saying, oh my God, my career is over. Like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this. Like, and, you know, he really helped me work it out. And, like, first of all, told me that, you know, you're not a single parent. Like, let's get that straight. And we worked out, like, how am I going to be a mum that works? I'm not a working mum. I'm a mum that works. I'm a mum first. Yeah. And how are we going to be parents that work? You know, we alternate Fridays. We don't, like, I work one Friday, he doesn't work on a Friday. My mum is retired, so she has my daughter 4 times a week. He's really helped me work out that schedule. And as I said, like, there's no one that champions me like my husband. There just isn't. So I do think it's important that when you're thinking about your career and your ambitions, that you have someone that, one, is as ambitious as you, because the ambitions that I have, he meets up to it. Because there's nothing worse than being with someone that you're ambitious and they're not ambitious. It's just not great.
Recipe for disaster, isn't it?
It is. You have to have someone who is ambitious as you, who is competitive with you in a really healthy way. Like, me and my husband are competitive, and it's not in a jealous or malicious way. It's like, okay, you're going to do this, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to push you, and I'm going to challenge you, and I'm going to see, can you meet this target? You've got to have someone who gives you healthy competition, but someone who's not afraid to tell you when, you know, this is driving you to a point where maybe your mental health is suffering, you need to slow down. And you're going to have someone that, you know, recognises their male privilege, that says, you know, I have privilege here, and I'll, you know, use it to get us through. Like, when I realised that men really preferred hearing the numbers from him when it came to investment, he did the numbers because it was about getting the money on the table.
Right.
When you know, people said, the most common question I got from investors was, why can't there be a Black Ballad for men? I've never answered that question. He's always been the one to answer that question, because I'm not going to throw myself in the ring and argue with a man about this question, because it'd be a losing battle for me.
Yes.
He always answers it. So I think she's completely right. And I'm going to be honest, I don't actually love leaning, if I'm honest. Like, I think it's very geared to a certain woman, and I'm not that woman.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's important that your partner, and especially if you're going to have a partnership with a man, because of how much privilege they have. And yeah. Yes, I'm in a relationship with a black man, so but he still has a lot more privilege than me in life. That they're able to use it to help you fulfill your career ambitions.
Yeah, no, I love that. Completely agree. Toby, can you tell us about your biggest financial showstopper and how you've overcome it? So something that might have, if not showstopper, something financially that might have had the potential to derail you, but which you've managed to overcome.
Black ballad. 100% in the early days. I said, like, my husband was my biggest investor, but I still had to put money into it.
Mm-hmm.
I had a part-time job. I worked freelance. And I'd pump all my money into Black Ballad, whether it be paying for software or paying freelancers. I didn't have savings for a long time because I was putting all my money, it was literally a circle. Money would come in my account, money would go into the Black Ballad account, and I would live on bare minimum. I'm someone that, I don't love debt, if I'm honest. I'm someone that doesn't do well with debt. So I only have one credit card. And I'm very strict on, like, especially when I didn't have a lot of money, I was very strict on how I used my credit card. I had to get an overdraft in the end when I went full-time freelance. But, you know, at 25, I didn't have any savings, you know, at, God, I think I just about started saving last year, and I've been able to save quite rapidly, actually, in terms of, I'm very privileged, I don't pay for childcare because my mum has my daughter, you know, I do a lot of speaking gigs, and I'm quite good with saving. But Black Ballad, I guess when you look at my friends who have been able to get mortgages before they're 30, and, you know, probably go on more holidays than I've gone on, Black Ballad has been my biggest financial showstopper, but it's also my biggest investment, so it's a bit of it's kind of like the things that I guess friends have had in a 9-to-5 have come a bit quicker for me because where the business is now and being able to, you know, I'm not saying I pay myself £1 million in salary. Absolutely not. That would be wild. But, you know, the skills I've got from Black Ballad, I've been able to leverage in terms of speaking gigs and being a specialist in this and that and the other, which has helped me, you know, have like a better income.
Yes.
So it's been that balance has been my biggest financial showstopper, but my biggest investment.
Okay, so final question then. Given the focus and even name of this podcast, Let's Make It Rain, can you tell us some of the ways you've made it rain in your life, not just in business, and why you're particularly proud of them?
Oh, in business again, I'd say Black Ballad, because it did come from like, you know, people started working on Black Ballad. I didn't pay anybody anything. I literally had no idea what I was doing. And the skills I had were so junior, and I was able to grow this business into a 7-figure business at the moment. So I definitely think that's definitely how I've made it rain. Where else have I made it rain? Oh my God, my life's been so business focused. Oh God.
That's no bad thing. We go through cycles.
I don't know where else in my life. That's really, really bad. I'll probably just say business.
I feel like you're making it rain in life. Like anybody that's able to forge a successful career, establishing this business and build, you know, on the basis of that business, you know, build a successful marriage in which, no one's saying that marriage is perfect or marriage is easy, but you're trying to, you know, you're running the two things in parallel. And so it's almost kind of straddling business and life anyway. So, you know, sometimes when we talk about this work-life balance, I'll never forget hearing a director for a company that I worked at who was like, Dav, I love my work. I love my husband. I love my children, but I love my work. It's a part of my identity, whether or not you agree with that position. But her point was, work-life balance doesn't have to be 50-50 for everyone. It means different things to different people. And so finding a rhythm or finding a balance that works for you is like the biggest boss move. And I feel like you're achieving that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It makes me feel a bit better. Maybe I'm not so boring. But thank you.
Okay, so now I'm going to ask you three quick fire questions. So number one, money is no object. What are you blowing the budget on?
Oh, now... right now, in this moment, like an amazing holiday right now in this moment. Yeah, not been away for 2 years and had a toddler in lockdown. I need a holiday.
Well, you do. Complete the sentence. A rainmaker is someone who
achieves financial freedom. Brilliant. I think. Yeah.
Love it. And the final question, finish this sentence. Anyone that knows me would be surprised that secretly I am
quite introverted.
Mm.
I don't like going out, and I don't like going out. And when I have to go to things, I get quite nervous at the thought of having to have conversations with people. I like to be at I get quite anxious and nervous that I'm gonna have to talk to people. I'm quite a homebody.
That is interesting. Yeah, because you would think, and especially when the things I see of you, you would expect, you know, this big extrovert, particularly running a media platform. So yeah, that is a good one. Thank you so much for your time today. It's been a real pleasure and privilege speaking to you. Where can people find you and find out more about Black Ballad?
So people can find out more about Black Ballad on our website. It is www.black, as in the colour, ballad, as in the song, no R, .co.uk. And then our social channels are Black Ballad UK. Again, black as in the colour, ballad in the song, UK, no gaps, no spacing, no underscores. And then if you want to find out more about me and what I do, I'm on Twitter and Instagram. And my username is I am Toby Rodane.
And do sign up for the mailing list. Toby sends out a fantastic founder's letter every night on a Sunday. I'm always so excited. I look out for it. It's one of the highlights of my Sunday evening. So it's worth signing up to the mailing list for that alone. Thank you, Toby. Speak to you soon.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Hi everyone, Davinia here. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. If any of what you heard resonated and you'd like to find out more about how Raincheck is helping women all over the world build sustainable long-term wealth, then visit our website at raincheck.com and join the mailing list for more commentary, tips and opinion on how you can start taking steps to leveling up your financial well-being today. You can follow us on social media at Raincheck, and don't forget to share, like, rate, review and subscribe. See you next time.